Patrick Karigaya, who was the former head of external intelligence and ended up being murdered in South Africa, almost certainly on President Paul Kagame's orders. The really amazing thing is that he was one of Kagame's oldest friends.
Patrick Karigaya left his car in the car park at Michelangelo Towers and made his way up to Suite 905. His family would never hear from him again.
He said that Patrick and I are like flies, and if it requires him to use a hammer to kill a fly, he will do it.
Preliminary investigation revealed that he might have been strangled as he displayed his neck was swollen, and police also found on the scene a bloodied towel as well as rope in the hotel safe.
Should everyone agree when the Rwandan defense minister said in relation to that murdered former intelligence chief, when you choose to be a dog, you die like a dog? President Kagame himself said, whoever betrays the country will pay the price, will face negative consequences. That's not your government basically nudging and winking that they were behind those killings.
Let me put it this way. I don't know anybody who betrays a country that gets rewarded. Let me just put it this way.
I'm Brian Kloss, and you're listening to Power Corrupts, the podcast where we shine a light onto the hidden and often nefarious forces that shape our world. Throughout human history, exile has been a way to get rid of unwanted people without killing them. From the Stone Age, when hunter-gatherers who broke social codes were forced to leave the band and fend for themselves, to Napoleon on Elba, our species has often relied on this implicit bargain. Go far, far away, never come back, and you can stay alive. Now, after hundreds of thousands of years of exiled people coexisting out of sight and out of mind, that bargain is breaking down. People who would have been exiled in the past are now being murdered. Today, we're going to explore why and how dictators have developed a much longer reach when it comes to eliminating their enemies. And that story starts on New Year's Day, 7 years ago, in South Africa. Patrick Karigaya, a former intelligence chief in Rwanda turned dissident and critic of his former regime, wasn't responding to calls from friends and family members.
Okay, my name is Michaela Rong, and I'm a writer and journalist specializing in Africa. My new book is called Do Not Disturb.
When David Batenga, Karigaya's nephew, kept coming up empty when he tried to contact his uncle on New Year's Day of 2014, he decided to track him down in person. He knew that his uncle was staying at the Michelangelo Hotel in Johannesburg, so he asked the hotel manager to send someone up to check on his uncle in room 905. They returned, saying there was a Do Not Disturb sign on the door, so they didn't want to bother the guest. When David insisted, they went up, saw a man lying on the bed with the TV blasting full volume, returned to the lobby, and told David that his uncle was asleep. "Did you speak to him?" David asked. They said that they hadn't. "You need to speak to him," David replied. And later, David got an update, with an answer he didn't want to receive. "Your guest is dead, sir," they said.
I call the book Do Not Disturb because the body wasn't found for a full day, and that was because his killers, very smartly, had hung the Do Not Disturb sign on the room door as they left, and that meant that no one would break into the room. Patrick's nephew, who knew that he was in the hotel, kept trying to persuade the staff, that Michelangelo, to open the room and find out if his uncle was there. But they wouldn't because of that sign. So it won the killers a very convenient delay, in which time they fled the country. They went to the airport and flew out.
Who killed Patrick Karigaya? Why did they kill him? And what does his death tell us about the ways that dictators and despots have shifted their tactics in the 21st century? To understand, we have to start at a pivotal moment in Rwanda's history, the tragic, horrifying events of the Rwandan genocide in 1994.
It is not like anything I've ever seen in 30 years as a reporter. It is, I think, the standard against which all future tragedies will be measured. For all up and down this road that leads north from the border, there is madness and horror beyond telling, beyond belief.
Over a horrific 100 days in 1994, roughly 800,000 Rwandans were hacked to death in one of the worst genocides in human history. Whenever you say the word Rwanda, that unfathomable tragedy is what immediately springs to mind for most people. But as the blood dried in the streets, a new regime eventually solidified itself in Kigali, Rwanda's capital. And for much of the world, that's when they stopped paying attention to what happened in that tiny Central African nation, a territory about the same size as New Hampshire in the United States, a place sometimes known as the Land of a Thousand Hills. From those hills, a general traded his rebel army camouflage for a dark suit and tie to become a president. Paul Kagame, Rwanda's strongman leader. And as he started to dominate the political hierarchy of post-genocide Rwanda, he drew on the help of one of his oldest friends, Patrick Karegaya.
Both of these men grew up in Uganda. Kagame was a Tutsi refugee who had fled into Uganda from Rwanda when these pogroms against the Tutsis were launched by the Hutu majority government in the 1950s and 1960s. And he'd grown up in a refugee camp. And there he mixed and met people like Patrick Karegaya. And then they began to cross paths when they were at school. So Patrick and President Paul Kagame were at the same school in Kampala at one stage. And then as young men, they both joined the National Resistance Movement, which was the guerrilla movement set up by Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni.
Karegaya and Kagame became key figures in the Rwandan Patriotic Front, a rebel movement that became Rwanda's ruling party in 1994. Throughout their early lives, these two men charted similar paths.
They both went into intelligence with the NRM. So there were lots of reasons why they were constantly mixing and crossing paths and got to know each other. And they would go to each other's weddings, to each other's parties, they would share a beer, and ended up eventually sitting together with lots of other Tutsi, Kinyarwanda-speaking Ugandans who were really Rwandans, planning the return to Rwanda, the reinvasion of Rwanda, which would allow these refugees to find their rightful place in the world.
If we fast forward past the genocide, how did their fortunes get intertwined again after Kagame sort of takes charge and starts to develop a security apparatus?
When they begin to, after the fall of Kigali in 1994, after this dreadful, horrific experience of the genocide, Kagame realizes that he needs Patrick closer to home because Patrick's a sort of key intermediary, key mediator with Uganda, which is the biggest supporter of the RPF, and just a very smart guy, and he needs his brains. So at that stage, he offered Patrick Karegaya a job as the head of external intelligence, and he moved to Kigali from Kampala.
Basically, that meant a lot of that was actually kind of propaganda efforts, diplomatic connections around the world, and providing intelligence to President Kagame on international relations and issues like that.
That's Jeffrey York, the Johannesburg-based African bureau chief for the Globe and Mail, one of Canada's best newspapers.
But ultimately, he was just one of the inner circle of Paul Kagame, had been close to him for a long time.
It would be safe to say that Karegaya enjoyed drinking at the trough of Kagame's power, and that he even endorsed Kagame's increasingly extreme methods for silencing Rwandans that he perceived as his enemies.
He was a champion and happy propagandist for the regime. He certainly believed that Rwanda had the right to pursue its enemies abroad. And what we know is that during the time that he was heading external intelligence, Rwanda was beginning its program of taking out enemies who had fled abroad, people it saw as enemies. So, for example, the former interior minister, Seth Sendashonga, who had fled to Nairobi, was the target of one assassination attempt, and then that failed, and then another one in 1998. And certainly there have always been people who've said that was Patrick Karegaya's doing. He himself always denied that, but it was certainly while he was in a position of a considerable power and influence.
When Michaela interviewed senior Rwandan officials and asked them about assassination attempts and disappearances of those who had crossed Kagame's increasingly authoritarian regime, She noticed that their responses were more winks and justifications than denials.
They were very aggressive, articulate, clever, convincing. The story they told was one of, you know, we have been through this horrific genocide. Our community, our Tutsi community, was nearly wiped out as a result of that genocide. Our enemies are everywhere. Many of them have fled abroad into Congo, but also to Europe. And we retain the right to hunt them down and to make sure that they never represent a significant threat. And I think all of those individuals were unapologetic about that. And what we see is that that narrative has continued, but with the passage of the years, it's become slightly, you know, it's become more divorced from reality, because I don't believe there is a sizable threat now in the forest of Congo by Hutu extremist genocidaire.
Karagaya was undoubtedly cut from the same cloth as those senior officials who were justifying increasingly violent methods to shut people up if they spoke out of turn about Paul Kagame.
He was a very active, enthusiastic part of the regime at that stage of his career.
Finally, though, Kagame started to get paranoid about one of the members of his inner circle. As the regime ramped up a campaign against a senior figure that Karagaya knew, liked, and trusted, he finally hit his breaking point.
That was a point where Patrick says, I didn't want to go along with this because I didn't feel it was right that one man should have so much power. That triggered a very suspicious reaction from Kagame.
But in speaking to people close to Karagaya, the spy chief who soured on his overbearing boss, Michaela started to suspect that this wasn't just a disagreement over policy. It was deeper than that. And it spoke to what inevitably happens to a paranoid leader who starts to believe deeply in his own cult of personality.
My conclusion when I was writing the book and listening to the testimonies of so many people who knew Patrick well was that there was a lot of personality problems between the two men. Patrick was, by all accounts, a brilliant man. He'd done extremely well at university. Everyone always talked about the acuteness of his intelligence, his sense of humor, his ebullience. He was very laid back. He told you what he thought, you know, he didn't conceal things. Whereas Kagame was a much more introverted man, very secretive, probably suffering from enormous inferiority complexes because he hadn't managed to finish off at school. He didn't possess the popularity of someone like Fred Rejema, the charismatic founder of the RPF. And so he felt the need always to prove himself, very suspicious, wary of anything that smacked of disrespect.
As Kagame consolidated power, he started to fall out with people who didn't fawn over his every move.
The impression I got was that Patrick became unacceptable to Kagame because he wouldn't kowtow. He knew Kagame too well. He told him what he really thought. If he disagreed, he said so. He wouldn't play the sycophancy game. And this, by the time that these disputes start happening, Kagame has been running Rwanda for a while and he's used to everyone doing exactly what he says. So I think there was also a real sense of that Kagame felt that Patrick had known him when he was young, vulnerable, insecure, and he was no longer any of those things. And now he wanted Patrick to change his behavior, and Patrick wasn't doing that, so he needed to be taught a lesson.
Kagame demoted Patrick, then jailed him. After letting him languish in prison for a bit, he was freed. But then Rwanda's regime decided to prosecute him, strip him of his military rank, and humiliate him.
And at that stage, he comes out of prison and his colleagues tell him, you know, you still haven't shown the kind of respect you should show to Kagame, and he's going to finish you off.
For President Kagame, this was a pattern, and it usually ended the same way.
So normally there would be an official carpeting where all the generals, all your sort of oldest colleagues, all your oldest and most trusted colleagues, you are called into a room where they're sitting there. At that stage, Kagame is almost never present. He always absents himself with some excuse or another, but is being told what's going on by people coming and going in and out of the room. And the generals will basically say, you've got the wrong attitude. You haven't said the right things. You've shown insubordination. The press is writing far too many complimentary articles about you, and the boss doesn't like that. And then they're told, you need to apologize and you need to write a letter of apology. And there's this sort of echo of these sort of cultural revolution of Mao.
In Rwanda, that's not a warning that you can take lightly. Around this time, Michaela had been contacted by a famous author who was doing research for a thriller he was writing that was to be set in the region. He wanted her help to research the area, to get a feel for the place, to meet some of the movers and shakers. So Michaela set up a meeting with the author and Karagaya. When they met, Karagaya immediately clocked who he was. The old Rwandan intelligence hand enthusiastically told John le Carré that he had read several of his books. When the lunch finished and Karagaya left, le Carré turned to Michaela and said, "Your friend smiled and joked, but did you notice that it never reached his eyes? I fear he will be rubbed out. There's a darkness gathering over him." And apparently, Karagaya sensed that too.
And at that point, Patrick fled the country in 2007 because he actually thought he was going to be killed.
But fleeing into exile isn't straightforward. You have to escape first. And that's hard to do when you're a well-known figure inside Rwanda's regime.
Kigali is about a 2.5-hour drive from the border with Uganda. These were roads and routes that these men knew very well because, of course, they had traveled along those roads when they were invading Rwanda as part of the RPF. There's a river, a stream, and marshland between the two countries.
But there are border checkpoints everywhere, so you have to get creative if you want to escape undetected.
So your driver lets you off, and then you either wade or swim across the river, tramp through the marshes. Your car goes through and then you meet them on the other side. And many politicians, journalists, human rights activists, Supreme Court judges have trodden that path because as Kagame has tightened his grip on Rwanda, he's now been in charge of the country for 27 years, more and more people have found that they've been crossing swords with him because he's less and less tolerant of any form of dissent or criticism. And so a lot of people end up feeling, I'm not safe here. I need to get out.
In the past, getting out of the country meant that you were out of the picture. You couldn't really be a thorn in the side of the regime from 1,000 miles away. But now, with the internet, social media, and a fully interconnected world, exiles can do immense damage to authoritarian regimes, even when the dissident is halfway across the globe.
If you are abroad, if you're organizing, if you are speaking to the media, if you are talking to the diaspora, if you're a problem for the regime, they will find a way to pursue you.
Karagaya realized very quickly that his life was still in danger, even though he managed to flee Rwanda and arrive in comparative security in South Africa. And that's because another political exile, a general who got too much good press and started to make Kagame feel threatened, got hunted down by Rwanda's regime while he was living in South Africa.
He was coming back from a shopping trip with his wife, and a man was at the gate and opened fire, and he was actually shot in the stomach and then tried to stab him to death, but they managed to drive into the compound. And that was one of, I think, there have been 3 or 4 attempts on the general's life, because they then tried to, while he was being treated in a clinic for his injury, there was then an attempt to launch a raid on the clinic and either strangle him in his bed or sort of inject some toxic substance in his IV. So having seen that, you know, Patrick was under no illusions that his own life was in danger. And from that moment on, both of those men had 24-hour-a-day protection from the South African military police.
There's even a series of alleged audio recordings in which one of Kagame's senior officials discusses ways to kill dissidents. Quote, "There's a thing someone could put in his food or his drink without him noticing," he says. "It could take days or months before it has an effect. Doctors wouldn't even detect it. You could administer it to him in his favorite soup. Don't worry. We already have used this technique before. It works fine." But it wasn't poisoned soup that Patrick Karagaya had to worry about as he and everyone else in South Africa got ready to celebrate New Year's Eve.
Like most people in South Africa, I was on vacation. I mean, that time of the year, the period between Christmas and New Year's and early January is a time when South Africa really shuts down. The whole country shuts down politically. A lot of newspapers are not even published.
As South Africa shut down for the holidays, Karagaya got contacted by an old friend, a man that he thought he could trust, even as he was rightly paranoid about the risks of meeting anyone from Rwanda.
A Rwandan businessman friend called Apollo was coming through.
And they were sort of hanging around in Johannesburg. They were going to various clubs, restaurants, and so on.
The two met up at the Michelangelo Hotel, a place that screams glitzy over-the-top luxury, complete with the faux castle turrets, located in the upscale Sandton neighborhood of Johannesburg.
An area filled with luxury hotels and expensive office space, shopping malls, and so on.
A spot where African politicians and movers and shakers like to hang out.
The two men agreed to celebrate the holiday together at the hotel.
Apollo and Patrick Karagaya were together on New Year's Eve.
And then Apollo invited him up to his hotel room in the Michelangelo.
And then Karagaya sort of disappeared from contact with his family.
Patrick ended up dead in that room.
When Karagaya's body was discovered, it was clear that he had been strangled to death with a rope.
He was lying dead on the bed, and nobody else was there. The people were long gone.
The Do Not Disturb sign had done its job. It had bought the assassins enough time to escape from South Africa, slipping out of the country before the body had even been discovered, lifeless on the hotel bed. But the culprits were nonetheless pretty obvious.
It was clear right from the beginning that South Africa suspected Rwanda of involvement. What subsequently emerged was that Apollo, his friend, had disappeared, had flown back to Rwanda. And it appears in this strong evidence that Rwandan agents had rented a room or paid for a hotel room in the same corridor, just across the corridor from where Patrick Karagaya was. What the police and prosecutors have subsequently said when this finally came out in the inquest was that those individuals were believed to be the killers, and they had close links to the Rwandan government.
The inquest dragged on and on, but nobody really doubted who was behind the killings. As Al Jazeera reported in 2014, Paul Kagame even made an ominous statement when he was asked about the murder.
At a meeting in Kigali on Sunday, the president is reported to have said, "You cannot betray Rwanda and get away with it. There are consequences for betraying your country. It's a matter of time. Whoever betrayed the nation cannot escape the consequences."
When pressed by another reporter, Kagame denied ordering Karagaya's assassination, but said that he wished he had. Quote, "I actually wish Rwanda did it. I really wish it." Shamelessly, regime spokespeople continued that nudge-nudge-wink-wink approach to Karagaya's grisly murder. Here's Rwanda's foreign minister at the time, Louise Mushikiwabo, being grilled by Mehdi Hassan, formerly a host on Al Jazeera and now a host on MSNBC, back in 2014.
Rwanda, as any other country that I know of, has its own way of doing things, and not everybody should be agreeing with what the government of Rwanda is doing.
Should everyone agree when the Rwandan defense minister said in relation to that murdered former intelligence chief, "When you choose to be a dog, you die like a dog"? President Kagame himself said, "Whoever betrays the country will pay the price, will face negative consequences." That's not your government basically nudging and winking that they were behind those killings.
Let me put it this way. I don't know anybody who betrays a country that gets rewarded. Let me just put it this way.
In perhaps the most telling move of all, Rwanda hasn't lifted a finger to investigate Karagaya's death.
There's been no attempt by the Rwandan government to do anything to solve this murder, to respond to the arrest warrants that South Africa eventually issued.
But why would they? After all, they already know exactly who did it. Karagaya's assassination is an important episode in itself of, as Michaela puts it, the story of a political murder and an African regime gone bad. But it's also part of a disturbing trend of something called transnational assassinations or transnational repression. In the 21st century, dictators have grown much longer arms, and they're using them to strangle or kill their opponents, no matter where in the world they're hiding, which we'll explore more after this short break. Power Corrupts is ad-free this season for your listening pleasure. But George, my executive producer and sound editor, has unfortunately not agreed to my extremely reasonable demand to work for free as my audio serf. So until I can convince him, we'd both appreciate it if you could support the show so that I can pay him. You can help by giving me the money to pay him by pre-ordering my new book, Corruptible: Who Gets Power and How It Changes Us, which comes out on November 9th. If you like this podcast, I promise you'll love the book. Or you can help out by becoming a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/powercorrupts. For as little as $3 per month, you can get episodes early plus plenty of exciting bonus content and Power Corrupts merchandise. This week, as a Patreon exclusive, I'll be speaking to the daughter of Paul Rosesabagina, the man who was immortalized in the film Hotel Rwanda. He was yet another victim of the Rwandan regime, as he was effectively tricked into boarding a plane that was supposed to land somewhere else, but ended up landing in Rwanda instead. He's been detained for roughly a year now. I got the inside story of his case, as well as how we can help bring more international attention to get him freed. And a special thanks this week to some generous supporters of the show, Phoenix Abel, Matthias Staten, and Sumit Verdi. Go to patreon.com/powercorrupts. And thanks for listening and for your support. Okay, great. So first off, could you introduce yourself and whatever title you want to be known as in the podcast?
Yeah, hi, I'm Isabel Linzer, and I'm a research analyst for technology and democracy at Freedom House.
I'm Nate Schenken. I'm the director for research strategy at Freedom House.
Nate and Isabel co-authored a groundbreaking report about transnational repression for Freedom House, a think tank based in Washington, D.C.
Transnational repression is when a government goes after people who have left the country. So you might be an exiled journalist. You might be somebody who emigrated for other reasons. You might be an asylum seeker. And you have left your country where you lived for whatever reason. And the government is still pursuing you, even though you have crossed into another country. And so in a way, transnational repression is a government extending its control beyond the territory of its national borders.
Rwanda, as you might expect, is a major perpetrator.
This is a country that's been pretty openly kidnapping, killing opposition and dissidents abroad for two decades.
Nate, by the way, is also a fan of Michaela's book.
I was so engrossed with the book the other day that I almost burned down our apartment. I left the stove on. I was too busy, like, getting wrapped up in these stories that I'm like, I know these stories. Like, I've seen these stories, you know, through our project, but I hadn't seen them told this way.
We'll come back to Rwanda in a moment. But first, it's worth pointing out that pretty much everybody in the world knows what transnational repression looks like, even though they don't know the term. And that's because of one very high-profile assassination that happened in 2018 in Turkey.
There's a lot of examples over recent history that are pretty flagrant examples that you can get away with it. The murder of Jamal Khashoggi by Saudi Arabia is, of course, the most prominent example.
On October 2nd, 2018, Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi entered the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. It would be the last time he was seen alive.
It started here at Ataturk International Airport in the early hours of October the 2nd, a sequence of events that led to the death of Jamal Khashoggi.
Khashoggi's body parts have apparently been found. We know that the Turkish authorities were looking in a forest area on the outskirts.
In the wake of the Khashoggi murder, Nate and Isabel and their colleagues at Freedom House set out to systematically study this phenomenon of dictators silencing their opponents who had already fled into exile. And as they crunched the numbers and pored over the data, they began to see that this was a horrifyingly common occurrence, even if most of the cases don't get the high-profile attention that the Khashoggi killing did.
What we really wanted to do was get a global picture. So what we found is 31 origin states targeting people who have left the country, so exiles and diaspora, in 79 host countries. And we cataloged 608 cases of direct transnational repression. So these are physical cases like assassinations, assaults, kidnappings. That really is just the tip of the iceberg.
For millennia, governments have tried to silence or kill their internal opponents. But Nate and Isabel were finding key 21st century differences in the frequency and the intensity and the tactics of going after political dissidents after they'd left the country.
Transnational repression is not new, but it's a growing problem now.
The biggest thing that's new, of course, is the technology. And that cuts both ways. You've got people being able to communicate back to the place where they left so much more easily. People kind of being in instantaneous, constant, daily, minute-by-minute contact, whether that's with family or with other activists, dissidents, you know, opposition, or through like YouTube channels, being influential political actors, media commentators through social media channels. So that's changed the way that diasporic exiles or activists can participate in the social life, political life of their country back home.
So we are more connected than ever, and in many ways, that's a good thing. Diaspora have ways to stay in touch with people in their home countries, but just as we are able to be in touch with each other more easily, states are also able to use those same tools to reach people who have left the country.
The state can monitor people more easily. A lot of that is public. It's just open source, you know, like, who are your friends on Facebook? What posts are you commenting on? Where did you post a photo of yourself from? Some of it is private, is like hacking into people's phones, whether you build that software yourself or you buy it from a private company.
And we see that in spyware. We see harassment on social media. And even just if you're an activist and you're using social media, if you're using YouTube, I mean, these are things that you need to use to have reach these days. You make yourself vulnerable without really having much of a choice, just by the nature of the tools that we use.
One of the strangest things about the ways these governments operate is just how blatant it all is. And that's by design. Because these intelligence operations aren't just intended to silence a specific critic. They're intended to scare other people into silence too, to make it clear that there are consequences to speaking out. The thing that strikes me as particularly dark about this is that, unlike in a lot of normal criminal activity, it seems to me that the perpetrators want attribution to be brought back to them with deniability, right? Like, they want everyone to know that they can do this. They probably want people to know that they did do this, but they want to be able to have legal deniability. I mean, do you think that that's a significant aspect of the strategy here, is to send signals, not just to the people around the individual being targeted, but also to silence future potential dissidents because everyone knows who did it?
Yes. And there's definitely a communication aspect of this for the regimes that are doing it, to show people that we can reach you. To show people that you're at risk, this could happen to you. And so, yeah, the communication around it is a big part of it. They want to, not to be flip, but they want to flex, right? And show off that we're a powerful regime, that we can reach across borders, that you're not safe. There's this way they talk about the operations that's very braggadocious. They call it, you know, sophisticated intelligence operation. This person had no idea what was coming, kind of thing. Where they're really trying to kind of perform for perhaps domestic audiences as well within the country to show how powerful they are at home, but also to other opposition dissidents abroad to say, you're never safe. We could always get you.
That was obviously part of the strategy around Karagaya's murder and the associated soundbites offered by Rwanda's president and foreign minister that implicitly acknowledged responsibility for the killings. And as Michaela points out, it worked. It had a chilling effect. So people would be paranoid about speaking to her on the record, lest they end up in Kagame's crosshairs.
When you first meet a Rwandan living abroad in exile, or anyone even just passing through, maybe a student or a journalist who's on a training course, they're very, very skittish. And they're very nervous about even being seen by you. And they're terrified. And they feel they're being constantly monitored by the embassy. And they don't want to talk to you via email. They will not express any personal views because they're convinced that their emails are being tracked. They don't want to talk on Skype for the same reason. There used to be a trust of WhatsApp. But then when there was revelations published by the FT that the WhatsApp platform had been comprehensively hacked by the Rwandans using Israeli cyber spyware, then nobody wants to use WhatsApp. And so it becomes quite difficult to interview people because they'll only tell you things face to face. And then journalistically, it's very frustrating because they never want to be quoted. So a lot of people will know things and they'll tell you things as long as you're meeting up with them face to face, and then they'll say, oh, you can't quote me, and you can't even suggest or give a hint as to who I might be. And after 4 years, I suppose, of research, I definitely had become as paranoid as all my sources, because I realized it wasn't paranoia. It wasn't that they were slightly bonkers. It was that they knew and understood the regime.
This isn't done haphazardly. It's a sophisticated, finely tuned operation designed to intimidate as much as possible and force critics to silence themselves before the state silences them instead.
So there's this extensive network in which the embassies all play a role of surveillance, harassment, intimidation, monitoring. So all these Rwandans, their details, where they are, what their opinions are, what they're saying on Twitter, what they're saying on Facebook, are being constantly monitored. It's an incredible surveillance state, basically. And I think it's very much a reflection of who Kagame is. He was trained in military intelligence. That was his job in both Uganda, and he applied those skills in Rwanda when he ended up running the country.
When Michaela met a diplomat who had been stationed in Rwanda, this is the advice that he gave her. On arrival, you'll be met at your hotel by a good-looking young woman or man. That's a honey trap. Don't touch the local fruit. During your stay, don't go onto the local Wi-Fi system with either your laptop, smartphone, or iPad, as they'll use that to get into your system and hoover up your information. You should take it as read that your room is being bugged. Don't say anything important or personal over the phone. Never leave your laptop or your phone out of your sight. And during the duration of your stay, you should assume that your luggage will be gone through not once, but twice.
If you're a writer like me, a Western writer, you know, I now walk down the street and I certainly look over my shoulder more times than I used to.
Michaela once had dinner with a young graduate student who was researching Chinese investments in Rwanda. She was followed everywhere she went. Soldiers would greet her by name, even though she'd never spoken to them. One of the soldiers even told her that she wasn't being fair to Kagame and her research. Then, as Michaela writes, the calls began. Her phone would ring in the middle of the night. It would appear to be a call from Rwandans that she had recently interviewed, but when she answered the phone, the line went dead. She checked with those contacts, and they had no knowledge of those calls, so somebody else was making them. Then, the most disturbing form of intimidation imaginable happened. One night, she received a call that appeared to be from her mom, who had been dead for 8 years. The student answered the phone. "It's time for you to go," the person on the other end of the line said. The student quickly left the country. I got a small taste of this personally a few years ago. In one of my Washington Post columns, I wrote about the importance of term limits in peaceful transitions of power in sub-Saharan Africa, and I highlighted how Paul Kagame was ignoring his term limits to consolidate power in Rwanda. Within minutes of tweeting the article, Rwandan trolls emerged and started attacking me, 70 or 80 vile replies to my post within a few minutes. The foreign minister of Rwanda even called me a, quote, subhuman white tin pot, whatever that means. Paul Kagame's daughter even piled on to attack me on social media. And I'd only written a few sentences about Kagame. For Michaela or Jeffrey, who were investigating and exposing the skeletons in Kagame's closet, the threat was much worse.
The insults that they use, the kind of attacks, personalized attacks, is clearly an orchestrated effort to attack the messenger, kill the messenger. So it's ad hominem attacks. It's not to, you know, this article is incorrect. It is, this journalist is a horrible person.
Anything I say is being picked up on Twitter and lambasted. I've been accused of being a genocide denier. I've been accused of being a racist, of being Patrick Karatkaya's a lover, of being a spy for Uganda, of having worked for the French military. And this just spews out from sort of a host of fake accounts that are, I assume, being run by Rwandan intelligence.
I know that you've been on this beat for a while, but when I saw that you're publishing a book that is in this level of detail, with this level of prominence, I mean, you have to be public enemy number one in the West at the point, right? I mean, did you have discussions with friends and family members about the personal risk to your safety And did you ever debate whether it was worth it? I mean, their intimidation obviously has worked in silencing quite a lot of people. Were you just determined to not be added to that list, basically?
Well, I certainly had second thoughts when I was planning the book. And I remember a friend said, if you write that book, that's the book that's going to kill you. And that's going to make anyone sort of stop up, you know, and think, But there were various reasons. I'm not in the first flush of youth. I've spent a lot of time covering my beat. I like to think I know what I'm talking about. I don't have any dependents. I don't have any children. My father died a while ago. My mother is in a nursing home. And I think those really were factors. I looked and I thought there won't be any collateral damage if something happens to me. That helped me make the decision. I know these things. I've got nothing to lose. If I don't write this, well, who will?
What Michaela has uncovered was certainly harrowing, but these weren't high-profile events. Virtually nobody has heard these stories in the US or Canada or Australia or Japan. Rwanda's just not important enough politically, and they kill people in such a targeted way that it doesn't affect the broader public. But sometimes, in order to send a message, other dictators make a different calculation, and they're all too willing to get quite a lot of bad press.
There's been a chorus of condemnation across Europe tonight after a Ryanair plane flying from Greece to Lithuania was diverted to Minsk in Belarus, and a dissident Belarusian journalist on board was detained. State media in Belarus said
the dictator of Belarus, Alexander Lukashenko, initially claimed that this Ryanair flight that he forced to land had been downed because of a bomb threat. But when the plane was inspected, there was no bomb, and instead, the plane took back off without the dissident it was carrying, who ended up in a jail cell where he was likely tortured. Western governments immediately responded to the incident, but as usual, the sanctions they issued were basically a slap on the wrist. The dictator of Belarus knew that they would come. They were baked into his calculation. He just figured it was worth the cost.
They're not really worried about those consequences. They're not worried that this will come back to haunt them in some way. They seem to think that this is something you can absolutely get away with.
With that impunity, the risks of being in exile have now been magnified yet again. It used to be that you'd be safe in exile. Then, you weren't safe in exile, but you were at least able to fly around the world, so long as you didn't land back in your origin country, where they'd obviously arrest you. Now, you can't even be sure that you'll be safe passing through hostile airspace at 30,000 feet. There are fewer and fewer safe havens for those people who flee from tyrants to survive. At least Belarus, though, is an international pariah. The really upsetting thing is that Rwanda is just the opposite, a donor darling that is widely praised by powerful people in rich Western democracies as a model for the rest of Africa. Western governments continue to pump huge sums of cash into Paul Kagame's coffers. That's why the New York Times dubbed Kagame the global elite's favorite strongman. While his government is busy hunting down those who dare question him, he's simultaneously attempting to show aid donors that he's delivering the kind of results that they care about. And it fits perfectly with a narrative of Kagame as a sort of post-genocide folk hero, which the Rwandan regime promotes as official propaganda.
Well, it starts with the perception that he was the one who was the hero of 1994, that he stopped the genocide. Now, that's an extremely simplified version of history and in many ways has a number of inaccuracies to it. It was not nearly so simple. He was not the hero who stopped the genocide. I mean, the genocide continued for months while he was slowly advancing across the country. So that narrative is very convenient for him, but it's oversimplified. That has still allowed him to be portrayed as a hero in the international, first in the international media. I think that has changed, but going back to the 1990s, there was sort of a media narrative that he was the hero of 1994. Subsequently, you know, he has cultivated a lot of opinion makers around the world. Politicians, whether it was Tony Blair or Bill Clinton, now Justin Trudeau in Canada, but not just politicians, also, you know, university leaders, especially development people, people in the development industry that were very impressed by his achievements in health and economic development, even though there's now evidence that those achievements are somewhat questionable or not nearly as great as some people perceive.
The story of an amazing, a rejuvenated country built on the ashes of a genocide, of a dedicated, disciplined, highly motivated rebel movement that has successfully turned itself into the civilian administration that's pro-development, attracting all sorts of, you know, economic investment from foreign entrepreneurs, a great partner, reliable partner in Africa, people you can do business with. It seemed to me that narrative had really taken root, but bore very little relationship to the Rwanda that I was hearing about. Because it has to be said that, you know, Patrick's murder was not the only one to that one can attribute to the RPF, that there have been a whole series of assassinations and attempted assassinations of journalists, of human rights activists, of judges, of politicians, and that there's a very dark, nasty underside to this image of a sort of Switzerland in Africa, which is the way Rwanda is often described. One of the things that really annoys me dealing with Western donors is that they seem to be unaware of how sinister and dark and pervasive this network of surveillance and monitoring and harassment is. Are we really sure that British taxpayers who provide, you know, such a large part of the Rwandan budget would be happy to know that this is the nature of the regime that they're, you know, helping to keep in power thanks to their aid pounds? I'm not sure they would.
Once they stick to a narrative, once they believe in a narrative, it's very difficult for people to change their mind. And so they have this idea from not much knowledge that somehow he was a good guy who stopped the genocide and that he's created an economic miracle in Rwanda. And that's enough for people. They don't want to look deeper.
This sort of Stockholm syndrome doesn't exist just for major Western donors. Even after Karagaya was strangled to death in a South African hotel room, the South African government also opted for a slap on the wrist.
Despite all that, you know, South Africa has continued to meet regularly with Rwandan officials. I mean, it could not ignore the fact that Rwanda essentially was trying to kill people on South African soil. So it did the bare minimum. It expelled a few diplomats. It downgraded the relationship. It protested. Over time, and this is again part of President Kagame's obvious strategy, over time, countries come to the realization that they'd rather have good relations with Rwanda than to chase justice for a case like this.
Why are you putting your relationships with donors and friendly African governments at risk by sending teams of commandos to bump off or harass or intimidate Rwandan exiles living on their soil? I think the answer is that having done it once, the Rwandans got away with it. There were no repercussions. They never paid any price. And therefore, what you get is a sense of impunity. So there's this feeling of, well, no one's ever going to call us to account. So we can do what we want. This is what we do. And we don't observe, you know, we don't respect national sovereignty or international borders. If we have someone we want to go after, we'll just do that.
We really just see countries getting away with these multi-decade campaigns of transnational repression. And, you know, there's been some pushback here or there, but overall, we're giving countries free rein to pursue people around the world.
This is another one of those instances in which people badly misjudge dictators and despots by thinking they're just crazy. They're not. They're often highly rational. And in this case, the rational choice to make is to silence your critics using whatever means necessary, so long as you can get away with it. And why not? After all, it helps you stay in power, and you get to enjoy your megalomania, free from people who question you. A strong man's win-win. So if we're going to make it so dissidents, journalists, and other brave exiles can sleep more soundly at night, the slaps on the wrist need to be replaced with serious consequences. The kinds of consequences that make dictators and despots think twice before sending a hit squad out to an overseas hotel.
You also need to be able to address the impunity part of it. So you need to have consequences when people do it. They need to be quite clear and they need to be quite stark. Cutting off security assistance, shutting down assets.
This wouldn't be happening if Western donors were being more forthright in their relationship with Kigali and just saying, this is unacceptable. You cannot do this. You cannot behave like this. If somebody is living in exile in our country, is a Rwandan who's been granted political asylum, that's none of your business. You stay well out of here. And if you insist on this kind of behavior, we will close your embassies because they are clearly the key kind of point in any operation to abuse or chase these people.
Globally, there are plenty of terrible offenders when it comes to hunting down regime opponents across borders. Some of the worst offenders are China, Russia, Uzbekistan, Thailand, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Egypt, and Iran. Sometimes, these efforts even become international in extremely bizarre ways. Turkey allegedly offered $15 million to Michael Flynn, Donald Trump's disgraced former national security advisor, to kidnap a prominent Turkish cleric who had been the Turkish president's main enemy for years. The US Department of Justice filed documents showing that Flynn was involved in a plot to do exactly that, though Flynn's lawyers have denied any wrongdoing. If you're interested in more detail about transnational repression, Nate and Isabel's report is called Out of Sight, Not Out of Reach, and it's available for free on the Freedom House website. Or if you're looking for a shorter read, there's a great piece that Nate co-authored in the Washington Post called The Long Arm of the Authoritarian State. This problem is only getting worse. And until the countries that claim to be bastions of human rights and democracy punch back hard, brave people will continue to be hunted down and killed by ruthless regimes who refuse to tolerate criticism. So the question is this: are we going to try to stop this? Or are we going to just pretend this isn't happening, like it's somehow invisible, like the entire phenomenon is hidden behind a closed door that's protected by just a flimsy little sign that says, "Do not disturb"? The choice is ours. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode or you learned something new, please rate and review the podcast on whatever platform you use to listen. And if you're feeling really generous, tell your friends about the show, post about it on social media, or support the show by pre-ordering my new book, Corruptible: Who Gets Power and How It Changes Us, or by becoming a Patreon subscriber at patreon.com/powercorrupts. In the next episode, Fake IDs, we're going to meet fakers and fraudsters, from the wine industry to chatting with a private detective who has an unusual specialty, proving that people who faked their death are actually alive. Don't miss it. This episode was written and narrated by me, Brian Kloss. The executive producer was George McDonough, who also did the sound editing. Music by Scott Holmes. Special thanks to Astrid Wimman, who helped research this episode. Goodbye for now.